Podcast Macabre, Episode 6.
Corvus Curse by Barry J. Northern.
Cast Macabre is a horror fiction podcast dedicated to bringing you stories that examine the darkest sides of human nature. We give voice to new talent while revering the classics, but above all, we aim to have our listeners reaching for that light switch in the dead of night when you can't shake that gnawing fear that we squeezed into your ears. Oh, and by the way, Cast Macabre is definitely for adults only. It contains swearing in it, so if you don't like that, you can Today's story is Corvus Curse by me. Now, before you start to scream vanity press and run away, let me assure you that it wasn't my idea to run this. Whilst I was away on holiday, the editor of Howl, Dark Tales of the Feral and Infernal from Lame Goat Press, where this story first appeared, went ahead and recorded it for me. That editor is Mark A. Crittenden, who is himself a horror writer with many credits to his name, but if you really want to know what he's about, look up our show notes for a link to his recent interview at Pulp Metal Magazine, where he discusses our favourite genre, which is horror, by the way. His website is visionprimordial.com. Go there and have a look.
Barry lives on the south coast of England, the setting for Corvus Curse. Barry dredged the darkest corners of his psyche in an attempt to uncover those spiky little fears that affect us most deeply, and found that most of them were buried deep in childhood memories. It is his hope that in reading Corvus Curse, you too will become as scared as he. And now, we've a tale to tell. Corvus Curse by Barry J. Northern. I remember the night that my childhood ended, the event that precipitated the erosion of my innocence. I was playing with a bouncy ball in the garden after school. I love those things. When the midsummer sun lost its heat, I felt a sense of unease. One of my parents should have called me in by now. I'd heard no conversation, no clattering of pots and pans, or running of sinks. Inside, I called out. No answer. The washing up was still stacked by the sink. The TV was off. I found them upstairs in their room, my mother in tears, my father's face full of worry. He told me to wait downstairs. I wish I hadn't. I wish I'd had the prescience or the experience to stop him from doing it, but I was only 12, so I went down to watch TV. I heard a wooden waterfall. Was someone falling down the stairs? I raced to the bottom of the staircase, only to be knocked backwards by my mother. She was running, not falling, with her shoes on. She never wore shoes in the house. She looked at me and her face burst with sadness. Her eyes were shiny and black, all black, no whites. She grabbed her handbag and coat and fled the house, trailing a single black feather. Father dogged her wake with ineffectual exhortations, but his pursuit was cut short by parental responsibility at the front door. I remained at the staircase's foot, watching through a growing film of tears the distorted motion of the feather as it zigzagged to the carpet. A car door slammed. My father screamed and came back inside. The wells of tears filming my eyes broke the containing limits of surface tension. I wiped at them with my knuckles. The salt water stung my dry, cracked skin. The following weeks were bad. I don't remember much detail. My father moved out for a while until it became clear Mum wasn't coping. He moved back in and Mum went to live with Granddad. I remember feeling as though my world had been turned inside out. But this woefully common chain of events was only the beginning of my own unique nightmare. I said I don't remember detail. I lied. There is one event, just before Mum moved out, one frozen millionaire that still pops into my mind unbidden. Picture this. You see your mother on top of her bed, on her hands and knees, scrubbing away at something. You venture a little closer and see the bedclothes are covered in bird shit. She has it all over her. She screams at you to go away. And there was another detail. Throughout those horrible first weeks of living with Mum, slowly going mad, the nail on her index finger was missing. I'll never forget that. It made it all worse somehow. Granddad still lives, as he did 20 years ago, on the outskirts of town. One of the original 1970s housing estates, a jumble of ascetic brick boxes intersected by ineffective grass landscaping, a place in harmony with my new world, which had all the beauty sucked out of it. One Saturday, Granddad came to pick me up in his truck. The old truck only burnt half its diesel for propulsion. The rest was employed to form a greasy black cloud. Even now, a whiff of that smell transports me to that time. The back of the truck was always full of spades, sacks of rubble, and tarpaulins covering unknown jumble, all lightly dusted with an aromatic sprinkling of tarmac sticky pebbles, which blackened my hands when he let me ride up in the back. It was raining that day, though. After we'd parked, Granddad said he hadn't changed the paper tachograph disc in the dashboard. He told me to go in while he searched for the little box of discs, mumbling something about getting into trouble at work. His house was end of terrace, so I could get in by the back door. Mum wasn't waiting for me in the living room. I looked at the birthday cards Granddad had gotten in the week, placing them back carefully among my late grandmother's precious collection of shiny porcelain figurines. The TV was on, but then it always was. I retrieved the fat remote from on top of it, catching the smell of hot dust. I thought perhaps Mum had popped round to the corner shop. I looked out the window. Granddad was still fussing about his truck. I heard a muffled wooden bump upstairs, Mum's old bedroom. The sound was eerie, for I had thought myself alone. I sat down in my armchair, but another sound from above startled me right back out of it. It sounded as though furniture was being upturned and the contents of the cupboards were falling out onto the floor. I ran upstairs and knocked, but there was no reply. I could hear someone moving around in there, and then something knocked against the door. I called out, and my voice was met with my mother's screams. I rushed in to find my mother lying naked on the floor, curled up on her side in a fetal position, which provided her with some modicum of modesty, but which did nothing to lessen my embarrassment. She was lying in a spray of bird shit. She was covered in it. She screamed at me to go away, covering her breasts with one arm, waving at me with the other, and tears running through the shit on her cheeks. I shut the door and ran downstairs, crying. Granddad was waiting for me at the bottom. "Let's go have a cup of tea," he said. "Your mum will be down in a minute." I didn't question his calmness. While we sat in silence in the living room, not really watching Saturday morning kids' TV, I heard Mum come downstairs and use the shower, which abutted the kitchen. She came in smelling of shampoo, wearing her thick pink dressing gown. She had a white towel wrapped around her head like a turban, and was rubbing her hair by her ears as she always did. She smiled and asked how my week at school had been. I should have asked her what was happening. I should have shaken her by the shoulders and told her to keep it together. I should have, but I didn't. "Great, Mom," I said. "We got new computers." Back home that night, after what seemed like hours of painful wakefulness, while the sounds of Father's post-watershed TV drifted upstairs in waves of varying volume, I had for the first time what was to become a recurring nightmare. It is always the same. I'm at the top of the stairs. They're wide, and I get the sense I'm in a hospital or a large school. As I start down, I trip and I fall forwards, but instead of falling, I glide as though weightless. As I drift down, I see a figure standing at the bottom. It's a woman, but I can't see her face because she's wearing a huge sombrero and looking at the floor, tapping a stilettoed foot tip on the polished floor. I'm drawn towards her, unable to control my descent, the rhythm of her tapping foot increasing as if to mark my progress. I float within arm's reach of the woman, and the sombrero tilts back to reveal my mother's face. It's her face, her hair, but her body is a man's. She's grinning, more rigor mortis than humor. There's no life in her. Her face looms close into mine, and I see myself reflected in the all-black pools of her eyes. She reaches out with long, cruel fingers and tickles me in the ribs. Not a playful tickle, but a painful jabbing that breaks my paralysis and has me writhing to get away as I wake in bed, out of breath, still feeling the physical pain in the brief moments until full consciousness. The nightmares were always forgotten by morning, but the painful dermatitis in my hands was constant, just like Mother. Sometimes it got so bad the small cracks around my knuckles would bleed. Around this time, the dermatitis spread to my fingertips as well, which made it hard to retreat into my 8-bit solitude. Even my ZX Spectrum's rubber keys hurt to press. A vertical lesion on the pad of my right thumb troubled me the most. It began as a small sore like the other cuts, but within a week it had almost bisected my thumb. The hard skin on either side parted to reveal a deep white cleft. It didn't bleed. It didn't hurt at all, not even when I tried to pinch it closed. I tried not to think about what was happening to Mum. Now I wish I could go back as an adult and wade through the whole mess, shouting at people, but I can't. I was just trying to be normal. The dreams I could handle. I was bound to have dreams, right? And the dermatitis was irritating, but a common problem. Something a doctor could help with. What really precluded any sense of normality was to come on Saturday morning while I was getting ready to visit Mum. I used to enjoy putting my wet flannel on my face and sucking the water through it. Like I said, I was 12. It was one of life's few pleasures. So I was in good humor as I wiped at the condensation on the mirror in advance of gelling my hair. And then I saw those black eyes. The all-black eyes from my nightmare. Only now they were staring at me from my own face. I had been smiling, but the reflection looked dead, corpse-like. I moved back from the mirror in fright, but the reflection didn't move. It was still standing close to the mirror on the other side, as if the mirror were an oval window looking into another bathroom. Fright stilled my own movement, but not my reflections. It pitched forward, rigid, dead, and I screamed, thinking it would come through, but it fell against the glass like a dead weight and dropped out of sight. After that, it seemed like there were mirrors everywhere. Places I hadn't even noticed, like the big one at the top of the stairs. I averted my gaze, but could always see my mirrored self obediently obeying the natural laws of physics in my peripheral vision. Sometimes I fancied I had caught the gentle motion of a black feather too, but I never dared look into the mirror to make sure. I'm at the top of a flight of stairs. They're wide and I get the sense that I'm in a hospital or a large school. I trip and glide down as though weightless. As I drift down, I see a figure standing at the bottom. It's a woman, but I can't see her face because she's wearing a large sombrero. I'm drawn towards her, the rhythm of her tapping foot increasing to mark my progress. I float within arm's reach of the woman, and the sombrero tilts back to reveal my mother's dead grinning face looming towards mine so close that I can see my reflection in the black pools of her eyes. Her tickling, jabbing fingers play my ribcage like an accordion. Her eyes are black. She looks dead. Her cracked lips part as if to speak, but her mouth is full of black feathers. They tumble out like puke. She's gagging on them. They surround me, and they flow all over me. I don't wake up. Now her fingers are like knives, cutting into my sides, piercing my lungs, and slicing my guts. The feathers fill my mouth, flow into my body cavity. My vision fractures into 100 viewpoints like a kaleidoscope. After the nightmare loses coherence, it's as if my subconscious mind itself has fainted. The dreams got worse and worse in the following week, but they only plagued me at night. I could explain those away without questioning my sanity. I slowly began looking into mirrors again, trying to ignore that one incident for sanity's sake. What worried me the most was my thumb. Even though there was no blood, I wore a plaster around it because one morning I had peered into the crack and I swore I saw bone. I didn't want to look at it after that. That Saturday, when Granddad and I arrived at his house in a cloud of diesel, Mum wasn't waiting for us again. He said she was getting ready upstairs and wouldn't be long. I turned on the TV while he put the kettle on. I know I should have said something about Mum, but that would have meant accepting that something strange was happening to her, and right then I was aiming for normality. Mum's scream lasted so long I was halfway up the stairs before it ended. I heard the smash and the tinkle of a broken mug in the kitchen, Granddad's footsteps pounding behind me, but I got to the bedroom door before he could catch up. I opened the door on a waking version of my nightmare, a swirling cloud of black feathers. My first impression was wrong. The cloud resolved into a murder of crows, their flapping wings filling my mind. Granddad reached past me and slammed the door closed. "Don't let them out." "What's happening? Where's Mum?" "It's happening more and more now. Since your father left her, she can't control it. She..." "What? She what?" He shook his head. "No, it has to come from her. She'll tell you when she's ready. Go downstairs. I'll make us all a cup of tea." After half an hour, I heard footsteps. Then the shower. Then Mother came in wearing a dressing gown, towel drying her hair again, smiling as if everything was all right, until she saw the plaster on my thumb.
"You hurt your thumb?"
"Yes."
"How?"
I didn't know what to say. My hesitation was worrying her. "I cut it washing up. Someone left a knife in the sink. The same thing had happened to my father the previous year." I knew she didn't believe me.
"Let me see it."
Granddad got up from his chair. "Now look, Susan, I don't know about this." She turned on him. She looked angry and worried at the same time. She was intense, not dreamy as she had been, and more sane than I'd seen her recently, too. "I need to know." I paused. "Okay." I had no reason not to show her. I peeled back the plaster, revealing a clammy white band of skin around my thumbnail. The woman who had inspected my hands for dirt all my life wasn't having any of it. She turned my hands over. "Susan," Granddad said, "it might be nothing." I find it hard to describe what happened next. Too hard. Sorry. I must recount it. But the memory is painful. It gnaws at the roots of my sanity. My mother tensed as if every muscle in her body had suddenly become taut. She curled into a ball, the same fetal position I'd found her in before. Her eyes were wide and she was grinning the terrible grin from my nightmares, but the grin just kept getting wider and wider. I realized she wasn't grinning at all, but her cheeks were splitting apart. There was no blood, like the cut on my thumb. My mother continued to tense, tighter and tighter into a ball. Her face, hands, and bare legs were rent with ever-widening bloodless cuts, as if her flesh was translucent skin all the way down to the bone. Her towel turban unraveled and her brown hair turned black. It coiled and writhed about her head. She shocked me then by hurriedly taking off her dressing gown, but I couldn't avert my eyes from her nakedness, no matter how embarrassing or awkward I felt. How the sight of her naked body could be worse than that face-splitting grin or Medusa hair, I don't know, but it was. The cuts were bloodless like mine, a comparison that only deepened my horror, and they were widening fast. Then she did start to bleed, or so I thought, but it wasn't blood, it was a black substance. Thick like blood, but oozing out of the cuts like oil. The oil threw off a dark powder, like soot, a supernatural blackness that writhed and twisted its way out from her unnatural wounds. She flung her arms and legs wide apart like a maniacal snow angel, screaming, but her high-pitched wail was soon strangled by a flow of black feathers issuing from her mouth. The black stuff had covered most of her skin and was congealing, taking on the form of feathers as well. I remember confused feelings. Among them, relief that her nakedness was now covered. My mother's body was almost unrecognizably humanoid now. She curled back into a ball, half-formed feathers writhing all over her back like jelly. Then she flung wide her arms and legs again. There was an instant where her form held together, but like welling tears faded to fall, her body lost its struggle against the supernaturally transforming force, and her body broke apart into fist-sized pieces, flying outwards in the directions in which she had thrust her limbs. The flock of birds took flight.
Quick!
It was my granddad. He was racing around the room. I was barely aware of him.
Shut the doors! Shut the windows!
I shook my head. The cawing crows were flapping all around the small living room, falling down the back of the TV and knocking over the birthday cards on the mantelpiece. One tried to perch on one of Nan's figurines, but was startled to flight when it toppled over and smashed on the hearth, setting the crows walking about there to flight again too.
Help me, lad! Don't just stand there!
Granddad knew. I couldn't believe he knew. I saw some of the flock flying towards the door to the kitchen just before Granddad slammed it shut and realized what he was about. I looked around and saw one window still open, on the other side of the room past the small dining room table behind the sofa. Part of the flock was beating against the sheer net curtains. I jumped over the sofa and climbed onto the dining room table. Crows flew past my head to join the effort of their fellows. I reached around the net curtain, trying not to pull it back, ignoring the sting of hard wings against my bare arms and face. I grabbed the handle and pulled hard. I met resistance and pulled again, hearing a snap. I shooed the birds away from the curtain with my other hand, only realizing after the flock had dispersed that I had caught one of the crows in the window when I'd shut it. I opened it a crack and the crow fell onto the table. I shut the window and climbed down. Granddad was there watching it flail about too. Its wing was hanging limp, feathers splayed out in odd directions. As I watched, the room became cold and the bird's behavior changed. Now it was struggling across the dining room table away from the window. At first I thought it meant to escape, but then I saw that it was trying to rejoin the flock, which had begun to congregate in the middle of the room, whirling around like a cyclone underneath the ceiling light. The injured crow came to the table's edge, and Granddad caught it before it could fall to the floor. The crow relaxed under his expert touch as he gently folded its wings in his great calloused hands. He edged towards the frenzied whirlwind of feathers, so blurred with motion now that it was hard to see any individual creature. For some reason, then, I remembered Mum's missing fingernail and that single black feather that she left behind on the stairs. Granddad threw the crow into the whirlwind, only to see it bounce back out. It hit the floor and struggled across the patterned carpet towards the flock. I went to it and tried the same, pleading for it to rejoin the flock, but it was thrown back out violently, like a ball thrown too hard at a roulette wheel. It slammed against the sofa and dropped down lifeless. The cyclone ceased, and in its place, my naked mother span around on the spot, her arms dragging limply around her before she crumpled down into a heap. Granddad picked up her dressing gown and folded it about her, holding her tight, weeping until she regained consciousness. There was bird shit everywhere. Mum was sobbing into Granddad's chest, hiding her face from me. She looked up imploringly at her father, sobbing around a question uttered in a child's voice. Why? Then she caught sight of the dead crow lying at her feet and screamed again. She turned to me, white with fear, and now it was my turn to scream. The left side of her head was a bloody mess of matted hair, half of which was missing, some of which still stuck in strands to her father's shirt. Blood flowed down her cheek, soaking into her pink dressing gown. The blood flowed from a hole where her left ear should have been. I have trouble remembering the next few days. I was in a state of perpetual numb shock for the next year, but these effects were not due to what I had witnessed that Saturday morning, nor was my torment due to my own transformations, for it was clear that the cut on my thumb was the beginning of that inherited curse in me. No, my lasting pain stems from what happened one Wednesday morning following that strangest of Saturdays. I was just leaving the house from school when my mother rang. I answered it, hurriedly trying to cut the conversation short because I was late. My mother wanted to talk to me, but I was relentless in my quest for normality that morning. "You know I love you, don't you?" she said. I said I did, and then said goodbye and hung up. Sometimes I think if I could travel back in time to that moment, I'd gladly hit myself across the room for doing that. On the walk to school, my slow, witten, preteen mind slowly began to wonder why my mother had phoned just to tell me that. I walked straight past the school gates. I ran to the nearest bus stop. The bus made its excruciatingly slow way through rush hour and out of town to Granddad's house. When I finally got there, I was sweating and out of breath, as if I'd run the whole way, which may have actually been quicker. I rang the bell, but Granddad wasn't in. I got in round the back and shouted for Mum, but there was no answer, not even a bump from upstairs. I went up to her room to find nothing. I tried every room in the small house until only one was left. I knocked on the bathroom door, no answer. I tried the handle, locked. I banged harder. I kept on banging against the door, and then I kicked it and threw myself against it, crying and pushing and pushing and crying. The lock finally came out of the door, and I pitched forward into the bathroom in a clumsy burst of tears and hoarse sobbing. My mother was lying on the bathroom floor in her pink dressing gown, staring up at the ceiling with an empty bottle of pills lying near her outstretched hand. She was smiling up at the ceiling, a line of froth running out one side of her mouth. I tried to revive her, but I don't know CPR. It was too late anyway. My thumb healed by the following morning. No more dreams, no more visions. But she never stopped to think that her suicide would be a curse on me as well. She never gave me the choice. Would I have chosen her over having my body periodically ripped apart into a flock of birds? Any day. Any fucking day.
At Cast Macabre, we believe in paying authors for their hard work. Right now we're not able to do that, because we've got no money! So we need your help before they starve to death and descend upon us as an undead horde seeking payment in brains. We don't have a donate button yet. There's no point in having one until we have an audience to click on it. So follow us. Follow us! Spread the word about the podcast. Follow us and get your friends to follow us! Our first 100 followers will be put on the original fans list and we'll do something special for them. After that, there are plans afoot to do other special things like newsletters and such. But if you don't follow us, you won't be getting none of it. So follow us, blog about us, tell your friends, burn CDs, anything to bring horror-loving people to our door, and we'll promise you that that door will always creak and close mysteriously behind you once you enter. This episode of Cast Macabre is distributed under a Creative Commons Attribution No Commercial Non-Derivatives license. Share it, but don't sell it or change it unless I wasn't clear. Tell people where you got it and get them to follow us. This week's incidental music was by Venus Vulture. Visit venusvulture.com for more. The text of this week's story is copyright Barry J. Northern. Music by Pain Factor. And follow us!